The next case is Mile High Cab versus PUC, case number 2011 SA 312. Both parties ready? Thank you. Few housekeeping matters. Argument is set for 30 minutes, so that means each of you have 15 minutes. And counsel for the appellant, the Mile High Cab, got to keep track of your time. When you argue in front of us, please tell us who you are and who you represent. And lastly, I want to mention that there are a lot of folks in the audience. I see we have standing room only. We have iPads where we have all the briefs and the record is on our iPads together with our notes and linking into the case law. So if you see us messing with our iPads, we're not surfing. With that, we're ready for the argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Robert McNamara. We represent Mile High Cab. Now, Mile High's efforts to obtain a certificate of public convenience and necessity to operate a taxi service in Denver and the surrounding areas has a long and somewhat complicated procedural history. But the only question facing this court today is a straightforward legal dispute. Mile High contends that in order to keep new taxi companies out of Denver, incumbent taxi companies must prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the new taxi company will harm the public interest. The PUC, for its part, disagrees. The PUC believes that incumbent taxi companies can meet their burden as long as there is any possibility of harm to the public. And because both the plain statutory language and the overwhelming weight of the legislative history of the relevant statute clearly indicate that incumbent taxi companies seeking protection from competition from the PUC must show far more than just a possibility that the public will be harmed, the district court's opinion should be reversed and this case should be remanded with instructions to grant the certificate. Now, if I could, I'd like to begin by addressing a dispute between the parties about the appropriate standard of review in this court, because I think it's an instructive dispute. This is a legal dispute. It's a question about statutory interpretation, and it receives de novo review in this court. The PUC and the interveners have suggested that this court should only review the PUC's decision for substantial evidence. And that's incorrect, and I think it's incorrect for an instructive reason. The substantial evidence test would apply if Mile High were here arguing that the PUC erred in particular factual findings. And that's not what we're arguing. The only argument Mile High puts forth is that the PUC erred by imposing a legally incorrect burden of proof on the intervening taxi companies, a burden of proof clearly imposed by the relevant statute. Now, prior to 2008, an applicant who wanted to offer a new taxi service in Denver had to prove three things. They had to prove they were financially fit, operationally fit, and they had to prove there was a public need for a new taxi service. As a practical matter, this third prong proved to be effectively impossible, and no new taxi services were allowed in the Denver market from 1994 through the 2008 amendments. And what the 2008 amendments do is they retain the first two prongs of the old test. An applicant still has to prove it's financially fit and operationally fit by a preponderance of the evidence. And then the statute instructs the PUC to presume that there's a public need for the new service and to grant the application unless and only unless the parties that have intervened to oppose the application can prove that the public convenience and necessity does not require granting the application, and that the issuance of the certificate would be detrimental to the public interest. And Mile High's statutory argument is straightforward. We contend that prove means prove. We contend that prove means show that it is more likely than not that an applicant will harm the public interest.
Counsel, can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Obviously, in the PUC's ruling, it used different language at different times. A number of places it talked about something as being probable in the sense that it said, this would probably happen. Is it your interpretation that that means something less than a preponderance? Or if they say it would probably be the case, that they mean it's more likely than not that it would be the case?
Well, Your Honor, it's important to recognize that the PUC has ruled that the preponderance of the evidence standard isn't the correct standard. At every stage of this litigation, Mile High asked the PUC to impose a preponderance standard. The PUC does not impose a formal preponderance standard. I agree it's not totally clear from the record what standard the PUC and the ALJ used. The phrase the ALJ kept using was, could very well result in harm to the public. I don't know exactly what that means. I don't know if that's a 5% chance or a 20% chance. I think it's pretty clear that could very well doesn't mean more likely than not.
But you think when they said probably, because of other things they said, they clearly did not intend by a preponderance of the evidence. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's very clear that Mile High asked for a preponderance of the evidence standard. Other applicants have asked for a preponderance of the evidence standard, and the PUC doesn't apply a preponderance.
And when you say they don't apply, and I didn't get a chance to read through the entire record of that, is that because they expressly addressed that and said, no, your interpretation of the law is wrong, that's not what's required, or you're saying what they did in effect amounted to applying a lesser standard?
Both, Your Honor. The first time the PUC interpreted the 2008 amendments was when UnionCab applied for a certificate of public convenience and necessity. And that's really where the PUC's legal rulings all stem from. The PUC here is following what it did in Union, where it's essentially held that the new statute does not impose the sort of significant change that Mile High and others have argued, and that I think the statutory text clearly imposes. They concede that there's a burden on intervening taxi companies who want to keep new businesses out of the market. But they have not held those businesses, first of all, they have not held those businesses explicitly to a preponderance standard. But I also think it's very clear if you compare what the PUC has done under the new statute with what the PUC did and this court upheld under earlier versions of the statute where all of the burdens were on an applicant, there's no way to square the two. The level of evidence that was required when all of the burdens were on an applicant is large. It's a preponderance of the evidence. I think the best example of that is this court's decision in the Transwestern Express case, where it and the PUC expressly rejected the idea that the possibility of lower prices for consumers was enough to allow a new entrant into the market, requiring some more concrete evidence. So I think there's a clear distinction between the earlier cases where a possibility isn't enough to let someone into the market, and the PUC's actions once the burden is on established companies, where suddenly a possibility is enough. It's always going to be the case that there's a possibility that allowing competition will result in some harm to the public. But what the legislature has said is that a mere possibility isn't enough. If the legislature had wanted to say the PUC shall allow competition in the Denver taxi market unless there's a possibility of harm, it certainly could have said that. Instead, it said that the PUC has to allow competition unless interveners prove the issuance of the certificate would be detrimental to the public interest. That's not what the PUC has done. It's not what they've done in this case.
Well, the PUC went ahead and made some findings that it would not be in the public interest, didn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did the PUC go on and make findings that it would not be in the public interest?
The PUC's findings are that there's a possibility of harm to the public interest. The PUC did not find by a preponderance of the evidence that it would harm the public interest, and that's the legal dispute in this case. It's not clear exactly how high a burden. Again, the ALJ talked a lot about something that could very well result. In their briefs here, the PUC has talked a lot about substantial possibility. I'm not sure which of those is really the operative standard they're using, but neither of them is preponderance of the evidence, which is the normal burden of proof in civil actions in Colorado courts. I think that's clear as a matter of statutory language, that the PUC is supposed to demand proof from interveners of the current state of the relevant market. The concern in regulating transportation is, and always has been, as this court has recognized since the Morey case, this idea of destructive competition, the idea that letting new competitors into the market will result overall in less service for the public. And since Morey, this court has recognized that's the only reason for which the PUC is supposed to be keeping new entrants out of the market. And I think it's worth noting that the PUC itself initially recognized that it needed concrete evidence about what was going on in the market, about the current financial state of the existing taxi companies, because you need to know in order to decide whether there's going to be destructive competition, whether existing companies are making monopoly profits, that would mean more competition is better, whether existing companies are using profits in one area to subsidize service in an underserved area that they wouldn't be able to do if there were more competition. And we don't know any of that because none of it is in the record. The PUC initially asked the ALJ in this case to take evidence about the current state of the market, and it only changed its mind when intervener Metro Taxi moved for reconsideration, saying that it would be too difficult to gather evidence of the current state of the market and the current financial state of existing companies. But if evidence is too difficult to gather, that has to hurt the party with the burden. That can't hurt the party with the presumption. And in this case, Mile High was entitled to a presumption that its services were needed. And I think it's an important distinction from most, if not all, the other statutes the PUC administers, that here the burden isn't entirely on the applicant, the burden is actually on the interveners. Under the plain language of the statute, if Mile High or anyone applied for a certificate to offer new taxi service in Denver and could prove by a preponderance that they were financially fit and operationally fit, both of which Mile High proved in this case, if no one intervened in that proceeding, the statute actually requires the PUC to issue the certificate. The PUC doesn't have a free hand to deny a certificate in the absence of intervention. And since the intervener, and that means the interveners here have the sole responsibility to carry their burden. The statute imposes a clear burden, and this court has said, and in fact Colorado statutes say, that the burden of proof in civil cases is a preponderance of the evidence. I also think it's worth noting that this problem of not having concrete evidence in the record about the current state of the market is exactly why the Colorado legislature passed these amendments in the first place.
How do we know that? Do you think we need to look at legislative history? I thought you were relying on the plain language.
I am relying on the plain language, Your Honor, but we're fortunate in this case that the legislative history bolsters the plain language. The sponsor of the 2008 amendment, Senator Tapia, clearly said on the Senate floor that the reason to switch the burden is that applicants don't have access to any of this data, and this is all quoted in our reply brief at pages 15 to 16. Applicants don't have this data, but established companies do have the power to come in and say, allowing more competition will result in us not being able to provide service to the public, will result in our going out of business. That's exactly what the legislature thought was necessary, and that's exactly what they said when they adopted the 2008 amendments. And that's exactly what the PUC failed to demand of the interveners in this case. The interveners did not carry their burden by a preponderance, and the PUC didn't pretend to order them to carry their burden by a preponderance. And I think it's worth noting that there's sort of a pernicious two-step at the heart of the PUC's argument in front of this case, assuming for the sake of argument that Mile High is correct about how to properly read this statute, that the statute does in fact impose a burden and that that burden is a preponderance of the evidence. The PUC's position here seems to be that the PUC itself can impose something less than a preponderance of the evidence, whether it's substantial possibility, whether it's very likely to, and that it can then be reviewed by this court only for substantial evidence, again, less than 50%. And the result of that would be if the legislature has imposed a clear burden that says interveners have to prove that it's 50% or more likely that a new applicant will harm the public in order to keep them out of the market, that the PUC can impose a less than 50% burden, and that this court could uphold while still imposing a less than 50% burden, such that literally no one would ever have decided that it was more likely than not that a particular applicant was likely to harm the public. The basic instruction of the Colorado legislature in the 2008 amendments was to presume that competition was good. The PUC has countermanded that, has decided that it's going to assume competition is bad because competition is possibly harmful, is potentially harmful. Those are arguments best addressed to the legislature. Those are arguments the legislature rejected in the 2008 amendments. And with that, I'd like to reserve the balance.
I'm sorry, before you step away from the podium, if I could ask a quick question.
Of course.
I very much understand the arguments about shifting the burden of proof. That strikes me as very plain. But what specific statutory changes in the language do you rely on to show what exactly must be proven? What did it say before had to be shown versus what must be shown now under the current version of the statute?
Of course, Your Honor. Before, the third prong was an inquiry into public need, whether there was a need for new service. Now, and at the time, it was explicitly an inquiry into both the interveners had to prove that the public convenience and necessity does not require granting the application, and that the issuance of the certificate would be detrimental to the public interest.
So you're hanging your hat on the would be detrimental language, the new language.
I think they work together, but the would be detrimental to the public interest language is new. It's a new
test. That's the new test
wasn't present in the earlier standards, and Colorado statutes say prove means a preponderance of the evidence. With that, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Maria Kasson, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent Respondent, the Colorado Public Utilities Commission. Your Honors, this case is about, one, whether PUC correctly interpreted House Bill 1227 as that statute was actually enacted, and two, whether substantial evidence in the record supports the PUC decision, which denied Mile High's application for new taxicab authority. The answer to both of those questions is yes, and for this reason, the PUC respectfully requests that this court affirm its judgment and that of the district court. Now, turning to the PUC's first argument, the plain language of the House Bill 1227 and the rules of statutory interpretation supports the PUC interpretation of the statute, which is that House Bill 1227 did not repeal the doctrine of regulated competition in the eight Denver metro area counties, but instead reallocated the burdens of proof within that doctrine. In other words, what House Bill 1227 did do is it shifted the burden of proof regarding public need to the party or parties opposing the application, which was the case in prior version of the statute. Now, as the district court has ruled and this court has stated in the 2009 Eddie's Leaf case and other cases, the courts defer to the PUC's interpretation of public utilities laws, such as House Bill 1227, if that interpretation is consistent with plain language. And this is because PUC is the agency that is charged with the administration of those laws, and because the Constitution of Colorado and the statute assigned considerable authority to the PUC. In this case, the PUC's interpretation of House Bill 1227 is consistent with the clear language. Now, first, the plain language of the statute contains the terms such as public interest, public need, and public convenience and necessity. And those three terms are all components of the regulated competition doctrine and have a well-settled meaning in that context, which this court explained in the 1981 Morey II case. Now, one of the rules of statutory interpretation is that the legislature is presumed to be aware of and adopt the construction which prior judicial decisions place on specific terms such as those, if it uses them again in subsequent legislation. So if the legislature intended to repeal the doctrine of regulated competition and the terms, those three terms associated with that doctrine as far as the eight counties go, it could have easily done so, but it did not. Instead, it chose to retain that doctrine.
Kasson?
Yes.
I think I understand your argument, but it sort of goes around in a backwards way of, I think, Mr. McNamara's argument about the terms bear the burden to prove. So would you address that in the statute? How specifically do you argue that requires not a preponderance of the evidence, as opposed to what you're really arguing is the conclusion, which is bear the burden is a, you know, an accepted statutory term as well, just as public
Correct.
Necessity
Correct.
And so forth, public interest.
The PUC does not argue that preponderance of the evidence standard and the burden of proof does not apply. The PUC fully agrees that that's the applicable burden of proof here. Now, preponderance of the evidence goes to the burden of proof with which the elements in the statute must be shown, or the quantity of the evidence. And in this case, the PUC submits that that standard has been met, and the PUC has found by preponderance of the evidence that there was substantial possibility or probability of destructive or excessive competition.
You would agree that the language used by the PUC is pretty loose, though, and we don't exactly have those kinds of findings, or at least those kinds of conclusions of law that we would hope to see. What about this record suggests to us that, in fact, that's the burden of proof and the standard that they're applying?
The PUC has found that the interveners met their burden of proof and shown by preponderance of the evidence that there was...
You talk about possibilities and probabilities. That doesn't sound much like proof beyond by a preponderance.
Well, preponderance of the evidence goes to the quantity of the evidence that must be shown. And this goes with which of the elements that is in the statute must be shown. On the other hand, substantial probability or possibility goes to the substantive elements of the regulated competition doctrine or the quality of the evidence that must be shown.
And so along those very lines, looking at the provision here, it talks about the opposing party shall prevail upon proving, in part, that the issuance of the certificate would be detrimental to the public
Correct.
Interest. So how do you square that statutory language with the PUC's finding of a substantial possibility of harm?
Well, first, the PUC would argue that an absolute certainty of future harm, which Mile High appears to argue for, is not required because that would convert the rebuttable presumption that is in the statute into an automatic conclusion.
But wait a second. Proof beyond a preponderance doesn't require absolute certainty.
I don't think that's the argument.
That's not.
But they're just saying by preponderance, which is a specific legal kind of principle, and that's why I preface my question by saying the language used by the PUC is very loose from a legal perspective.
I would submit that the quantity of the evidence that has been shown before the PUC satisfies the preponderance standard. Now, that goes to the quantity of the evidence that must be shown, substantial probability or possibility, which this court has articulated that standard when dealing with future events in the 1980 Mobile Premix case, goes to the quality of the evidence that must be shown. And also in the 1981 Mori 2 case, the court discussed the regulated competition doctrine and affirmed the denial of an application when commission found that destructive or excessive competition was, quote, likely to result and that it was not inconceivable. And
could you just use these terms, quantity and quality, explain, resort to Cape's Law for a second? What do you mean by what's the concepts? So that's a little different than the kinds of things we're used to dealing with.
Well, preponderance evidence goes to how much evidence must be shown.
Isn't the amount of the evidence, it's the convincingness of
Correct.
The evidence,
Correct.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
So what's the difference between quantity and quality?
Well, quality of the evidence goes to whether or not must the intervener show with absolute certainty that there would be proof of harm or that substantial possibility?
See, I don't think that's our test. Even in criminal case, you don't get to absolute certainty, which is proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct.
51%.
Correct. The PUC submits that this test has been shown here and that the evidence that has been introduced in the record
establishes a preponderance.
Correct.
Do you think there's a difference between a possibility and a preponderance?
I believe that those two are entirely consistent in this case.
I don't see that. I mean, it says would be detrimental, would be detrimental. So let's assume this is a mixed findings of fact, conclusion of law kind of standard, which is reviewed de novo. Don't we have to have a set of findings and conclusions that say that issuance of the certificate would be detrimental? I mean, that's the plain language, right? So can you point us to that? Where is the finding that it would be detrimental?
Well, in this case, the PUC relied on both expert and lay testimony to find that the issuance of the certificate would be detrimental to the public interest.
And they found that?
Yes.
Okay, and so then we look at the evidence to see if it supports that conclusion. Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and what supports that conclusion? Can you just summarize it for us?
Yes, what supports that conclusion is Dr. Ray Mundy's recent empirical study of the Denver metro area taxicab market and the expert testimony by Dr. Paul Dempsey. Now, what Dr. Mundy has testified is that the market was either oversupplied or close to oversupply, especially after entry and expansion of two other taxicab companies, which have been filed very shortly after House Bill 1227 was enacted and before Mile High filed its own application. Now, the record also includes evidence of lay witnesses closely familiar with the market through their employment or professional affiliation. And those witnesses testified about the effects that have occurred after the commission granted those two prior applications. Those witnesses included representatives of the Denver Hotel and Convention Bureau, the Hotel and Lodging Association, the Denver City Council, and taxicab drivers themselves. Now, Mile High does not mention those witnesses at all in its briefs, but those witnesses have all testified about the oversupply of taxicabs in the Denver metro area that Mile High wished to serve, and it was consistent with the expert opinions and supported the findings that the market would be oversupplied, and that when combined with those two previous applications, would result in a 49% increase in supply in only 18 months.
Could I ask, interrupt and ask you a question about the relationship here between what the PUC found and what the evidence was? Do you believe that based on the evidence we could find that the case was established by a preponderance of the evidence, even if we were to find that the PUC did not have that in mind and didn't articulate that as a standard?
Your Honor, I believe that the PUC has applied the preponderance of the evidence standard and has found that the statutory tests have been met. Now, if this court, assuming for purposes of the argument, were to find that the PUC erred in some way, the remedy would not be to grant the application as Mile High suggests, but it would be to remand it to the PUC to then apply the evidence of record against this test that the court would articulate.
Thank you. And could I just follow up on that one? You've said that several times, that you believe the PUC did find by preponderance. And just so I understand, you're relying on their language of substantial possibility because you think that equates with a preponderance of the evidence standard. Is that right?
I believe that it's consistent with the preponderance of the evidence standard in this case. And also, regardless of the precise language used by the PUC, I believe the quantity of the evidence was sufficient to find there was preponderance of the evidence.
And that last part is the part that I was trying to get at with this question. So, but you're saying, regardless of whether they found it, you think that there was substantial evidence of it?
Yes.
So are you saying we could make that determination, or with regard to what you said last, are you saying we should remand to them to make that determination?
I believe that if this court finds that the PUC applied an incorrect legal standard in some way, the appropriate remedy would be to remand. And that's because, as the case law makes clear, on judicial review, the courts do not make findings of fact on their own, but instead review the findings of fact made by the PUC. And so the only way that Mile High can prevail upon its argument that its application should be granted is if the court finds that the intent, not only that the PUC erred, but the intent of the statute was to rubber stamp all new applications. And
but why is that? Rubber stamp? Why is
rubber stamp.
Why do you say that?
Well, because the statute in the PUC requires, the statute that the PUC applied requires the PUC to make certain findings would be detrimental to the public interest. Does public convenience and necessity require this application? And so essentially the only way that Mile High can prevail upon its claim that the court should here today grant its application if that language has no meaning.
I understand the rubber stamp part. If we were to remand this case for a new hearing because we find that the proper standard was not applied, that wouldn't require a particular result, right?
No, absolutely not.
So rubber stamp isn't the correct word,
I'm
right?
I'm saying that's the only way that Mile High can prevail upon its argument that its application should be granted here today as opposed to remanded to the PUC.
And so before you move on, can I just ask you to go back to where you started, which was, I guess, interpreting the statute. I am wondering how much of kind of deference to the PUC plays a role in interpreting the statute, or do I hear you saying that you concede, excuse me, that we apply de novo review to the interpretation of the statute and that the statute requires a preponderance?
Okay. I believe that as the district court has ruled and this court has stated in the Eddie's Leaf case, The courts defer to the PUC's interpretation of the statute if it's consistent with plain language, and the PUC submits that that's the case here.
But we're not bound by that. I mean, we can give a difference, but I mean, this is the first opportunity we've had to construe this language, and our basic job is to construe it. You would agree with that?
That's correct. And before I end, I'd just like to supplement my sufficiency of the evidence argument. As this court has stated only a few months ago in the Office of Consumer Counsel versus PUC case, the standard of review regarding sufficiency of the evidence is that the PUC must merely show which of the evidence it accepts as competent and worthy of belief and which of the evidence it rejects. And the PUC has done so here because its decisions show it has accepted the evidence presented by the interveners as competent and worthy of belief.
Yeah, but you're just going to the weight and evaluating and so on.
Correct.
But you're saying that the PUC definitely said that it would be detrimental to issue the certificate.
Correct.
And ultimately, that's what we're talking about, is that a certificate is still required.
Correct.
So all we've done is shift the burdens. The burden of proof, the burden of going forward, they've introduced a presumption, but ultimately the PUC has to decide whether or not to issue the certificate.
That's correct.
Now, you would agree, though, that there is a pro-competition policy at issue here that is different, maybe, than what existed before in the statute.
That's correct, and the PUC would submit that the pro-competition policy is entirely consistent with the burden, with a shift in the burden of proof and the way that the PUC interpreted the statute. If I may sum up.
Sure.
The PUC would respectfully request that this court affirm its judgment and that of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Just one quick point in response, Your Honors. The preponderance of the evidence standard doesn't just refer to the quantity of evidence that has to be in the record. It refers to the findings the PUC has to make and did not make in this case. Preponderance of the evidence does not mean possibility, nor does it mean substantial possibility. And this court has ample experience dealing with the preponderance of the evidence standard. I just refer you to the cases collected in footnote 7 of People v. Ramirez, cited in our briefs.
But you don't, they didn't make a finding that it would be detrimental to issue the certificate?
No, actually, the ALJ's, if I can finish my response, right. The ALJ's evaluation of the very evidence counsel just summed up for the court was that the expert witnesses testified that Mile High's application, quote, could very well result, end quote, in harming the public. And this is paragraphs 210, 227, and 230 of his opinion. I don't know exactly what could very well result means, but it's not a finding of more likely than not. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank both attorneys for their briefs and their arguments. The case will stand, be submitted on the briefs.